Welcome to Amici, news and insights from the New York Judiciary and the Unified Court System. I'm John Carr. For the past couple of years, the Gender Fairness Committee of the 3rd Judicial District has been compiling oral histories of the pioneering female judges and attorneys in the 7-county region around Albany. A film documentary on the pioneering woman judges was recently reposted to the court system's YouTube channel at NYCOURTS, New York Courts. The Gender Fairness Committee, which is chaired by retired Judge Rachel Kretzer, an adjunct professor at Albany Law School, is continuing this project with a series of oral history interviews with some of the pioneering women lawyers in the region. This week, we're excited to share with you an interview Judge Kretzer and I conducted with attorney Marge Currow.
It is April 10th, 2018, and we are talking with Marge Currow. Marge, let's start at the beginning. Always a very good place to start. Where did you get the idea that a girl could be a lawyer?
Let me say that that question is not applicable to me. I was not a girl. We had no role models in our family. Nobody in the history of the family had ever been a lawyer. I wanted to become a lawyer when I was in my 40s, and I was watching... I had 6 children. I was watching the 1968 presidential campaign with one of those children, the Democratic campaign with the tear gas and the police chasing down demonstrators
in Chicago.
And to me, because I was white and middle class, that had never been a part of my world. In retrospect now, if we look, it probably was always a part of black world. But it was so shocking to me, and I thought there has to be a better way to settle disputes. This is not my country. This is not happening in my country. And to me, the law was the alternative to dispute resolution, taking away the guns or the tear gas or the bully clubs. Taking aware of the fear and the violence and the aggression and trying to settle it in a reasonable way according to reasonable rules. And so that's what took me into law, and I really wanted to be a civil rights lawyer.
What were you doing at the time?
I was raising 6 children who ranged, there were only 9 years between them, so it was a handful of a family. I had to wait, because Schenectady school system didn't have a lunch program, I had to wait until I found a lunch program so I could send my 3 younger ones to a school that they could stay all day, and I could go to law school during the hours. So about 40 minutes after I located the lunch program, I decided to sign up for law school or try for law school.
Now, where did you go as an undergrad?
As an undergrad, I went to Smith College, and it was 20 years between my BA degree and my entry into law school.
What's your BA degree in?
Theater.
Really?
Yes. Huh. I was a set and lighting designer, mostly off-Broadway and in winter and summer stock.
So then you decided, and what year are we talking about now to go to law school?
1971.
Okay. At that time, the legal profession certainly was gaining some prominence in a lot of ways. There's a lot of civil rights lawyers, and Thurgood Marshall comes to mind.
Yes, it was the civil rights movement that really brought lawyers into the spotlight as activists and as a way to implement a certain political policy. Until then, lawyers were just lawyers. They were working mainly for people who had money or corporations, and they were not really in the spotlight.
Were there any prominent women civil rights lawyers at that time?
I was not aware of any.
I'm hard-pressed to think of any myself at the moment. So, Albany Law School in the early 70s, I don't imagine you had a class full of women.
I think we had 15, and the class before me had 5. And I'll tell you, until a few years ago, I thought that they were the vanguard of women lawyers at Albany Law School. But a college friend of mine told me she was collecting stories of women who should have been in history. She's in Utica. And told me that her mother had gone to Albany Law in 1934. And that was never any information that any of us had. We thought we were, you know, the starters. And one of the projects that I never got off the ground was to find out the history, to go back in history and find out who were the women who graduated from Albany Law. But setting that aside, I just want to tell you, when I decided to go to law school, I did not get pushback from my family. I got pushback from relatives of mine, one of whom was the president of Wittenberg College out in Ohio, an uncle, who called me and said, "What are you doing to your family?" Because I had been this kind of super mom with the kids, and they were all good kids. They were all doing well in school, and I was involved in a million things. And he saw that quite clearly as something that I was taking away from my family and doing for myself, and that was not consistent. And he was an educator.
So you go to Albany Law School, I understand, right, in a psychedelically painted VW van. Is this true?
What happened was that with six children, you have to have a VW van. There's no other way to cart them and all their paraphernalia around. And since they were small, they left things in the driveway, like bicycles and carts, and I ran into them routinely and ran into trees and things. And every time I did, this was the 60s, that I pasted a psychedelic flower over the dent so my husband wouldn't see it. And then finally, I had enough of them there that one of my husband's patients, very sweet, artistic girl, said, "Would you like me to connect them?" And so she came and painted vines and flowers and things. Yes, I did have a psychedelic bus. And everybody in the Capital District knew where I was at any given time in my life. And when I graduated from law school, I said to my husband, "I am not driving this bus. I'm a lawyer now. So I need a regular car. I need a regular person car."
Judge Doyle, who would have been at the law school just a little bit after you, I think, told us a story about how there were insufficient restrooms for a woman, and if you happened to be on one side of the building, you ran across New Scotland Avenue to go to Albany Med because you couldn't get to the other side of the campus and back to your class in time.
That I don't remember, but I do remember that the big brouhaha in my class is I think we started the Women's Law Caucus in that year, but we wanted a women's lounge for that purpose, and a place where you could just relax and be alone, because the cafeteria was filled with the boys playing cards. And so we took a bathroom that had been a male bathroom and its adjacent lounge, and you could not really have foretold the brouhaha that raised, that we were taking something away from them. And we did get it, and I think it always has been since then, maybe a women's lounge with a bathroom and a place to really kind of relax and be a little bit private. But it developed into a huge fight, and they really felt deprived. They felt that we were encroaching by just being there, but then we were encroaching by actually encroaching.
So let's go back to that encroaching by being there. What sort of attitude did you get there?
Oh, very. It was a culture of why are you here? You're taking up the place of a man. My stock answer to that, to the two kids who sat, Randy Ezick was on one side, Don Fox was on the other. Randy Ezick was just totally male chauvinist. And he was the one who always said that, sort of every class that he met me in. And I would say to him, "You know, Randy, if that man were as smart as I am, he'd be sitting here." But let me give you another example. That was the during the year that Senator Day O'Connor was appointed to the Supreme Court, and Wallace had a, what was his first name? He taught real property. Started out by asking, now you're a freshman, you're sitting in a group of, 300 kids, to stand up and speak is a very anxiety-provoking thing, even though I was older. But Wallace began asking the young women in the class, why should there be a woman on the Supreme Court? And they were obviously uncomfortable and unprepared and very anxious. And I think I waited two or three of those questions. And then I raised my hand, and he was always very snide to me. Yes, Mrs. Carew, he would always mispronounce my name. What do you have to say? I said, I think you're asking the wrong question. You should be asking, why shouldn't there be a woman on the Supreme Court? And that kind of ended all that questioning. It was one of the very few times in my life I've ever been able to think of an appropriate thing to say at the time it needed to be said. Usually 3 days. Or 3 days. I obsess about it until I get an answer I'm satisfied with, which could be up to a week later. But that was the culture, was to embarrass the young women, to put them on the spot, to put them on the defensive. Why are you here? You're only going to get married and have children, never practice law. We need to be here. We need to make a living. You don't. Or you won't, because you'll get married and some man will support you. It was all of that culture.
Now, this is 10 years before Sandra Day O'Connor, right? She got there in the 81, 82?
Well, I remember that question. I remember it, and it must have been freshman year, because we were sitting in this big... maybe there were rumors of appointing a woman to the court.
Or discussion of
it. Yeah, a discussion of it.
She was a Reagan appointee.
Yes, I remember that.
Reagan didn't come in until 81.
But I remember it, and I remember sitting in what would have been the freshman classroom, those big classrooms with lots and lots of people, because after freshman year, you kind of had smaller seminar kind of classrooms or smaller groups of students.
Now, did you have an advisor?
No.
Were there any professors, administrators who were particularly welcoming and supportive? Or were they all...
Not that I recall. I don't think they were antagonistic.
Or agnostic, maybe.
There was one, Dave Pratt was always so... He was always friendly and supportive, and when you talked with him, you felt like a lawyer. You felt like he answered... as a lawyer. You were talking as equals. But he's the only one that I remember having any commerce with in terms of the professors.
And there were no women professors?
Back then, I think about Mary Helen, but I think she came in later. Kathy Katz
came later,
because she was a contemporary of Madonna's. They were in practice together, actually.
Now, so after law school...
We leave law school, how did you do in law school?
I did very well in law school. And, I have two examples of being able to think of the right thing at the right time, which is not so much... not such a high bar for being as old as I am, but this same... Randy, who sat next to me and always was insulting to me, prided himself on being very bright, especially in tax. The tax professor was very new, and like many new teachers, picked out the bright student and had a conversation with that student, and the rest of us just
listened.
And some days I thought I knew everything, and then you go in the next day and you think, I haven't a clue as to what they're talking about. So my husband, who was very, very bright, very good with numbers, sat down with me with a tax return, and it made sense what all these things were encouraging or discouraging. And so I really aced the tax exam. So Randy saunters up to me in the cafeteria, and he says, oh, how did you do on the text? Thinking, of course, that I was way down the... I said, Randy, how did you do? And he said, oh, I don't know, I got a 79 or something, which was a very good mark. I said, oh, that's too bad. Mine was higher. I just walked away. I went, yes, yes!
Let's back up again. What was your reaction of your husband and children when you decided to go to law school?
My husband was very supportive because he grew up in poverty and he grew up in a culture that revered education and revered a profession. He was Jewish and you had to be a lawyer or a doctor. He was a doctor. So when I said I wanted to become a lawyer, that was fine with him. And he was enormously supportive in my doing it. Physically, not so much. He was a workaholic, so it wasn't like he came and took care of the kids or cooked meals or any of that. He didn't do that, but he always let me know that he was proud of me for doing this and supported me and that he thought I would do it well. And that was enormously important because a lot of other people were telling me that I was a bad mother for doing it. My kids,
Did you ever think that or question yourself about what it was?
I did not, because I had been a super mom for 24/7 for years until my youngest was in first grade full time. And I figured I've been there, I've done that. The kids are in school, and I tailored my classes to taking them all to their various schools, dropping them off, and then going to my school, and then picking them up. This is on cold winter days, or being home when they came home. Unfortunately, I missed trial tactics and some of the other ones who were taught by lawyers who couldn't teach during the day, so they came after work and taught. I couldn't take any of those courses because I needed to go and collect my kids.
So your oldest child at that time was about how old?
Well, if I start with one, I can get them all right. So the youngest was in first grade.
Let me rephrase it. What was the reaction of your children?
My children, I thought, profited by it because every night at dinner, because I always insisted we all be together at dinner. It was the only time that we were all together for any length of time. And I would talk about my cases, and I'd tell them what the issues were, what the facts were, and then we'd go around the table and everybody would try to guess how it should have turned out. So I think they enjoyed it. And I think they profited by it because we had lots of really interesting conversations that would center around ethics, moral obligations, things that would come up in the cases in the law. How should this be decided? Along what lines? And I treasured those dinner table conversations, and I like to think they did too.
I bet that they did.
Well, I've watched them watching her get an award.
Yeah.
And I've seen the tears almost welling up in the eyes and the pride in the face. And
yeah.
So,
it was.
Yeah. They're very proud.
My son, my fifth child, is a doctor in Boulder, and he has three kids, and he came, brought his family up to the Sagamore when I received an award from the Women's Bar. And they were all dressed up and scrubbed and cleaned, and I thanked him for it. I said, Matt, that was so wonderful of you to just like bring them all here. And he said, Mom, he said, I owe it to my girls. So something rubbed off somewhere.
So you get out of law school, and then what's your first job?
This is very interesting because I graduated cum laude. I was on Law Review. And I sent out resumes, and I did not get a single response. In those days, even...
Got resumes in this region all over?
No, in this region, because this is where my family was. So I sent it out to Albany Skinner. I remember going to Howie, talking with him about a clerkship, because I thought it would be really interesting.
Howie, we were talking about Judge Levine?
Yes, sorry. I thought it would be really interesting to watch a judge and to learn from that perspective. It was just, would be a gold mine of further education and learning.
At that time, he was a Schenectady County Family Court?
Yes, yeah. There were no clerkships available, but I never got a single response. And at that time, the civil rights law was passed in 1964, and that did include sex discrimination. DeGraff, Foy, Conway, and Holt Harris at that time was Albany's leading law firm and had been for several years. They had a standing order at Albany Law School not to send them any women. And they had a woman partner who was Greta, who left to form her, Greta Powers, who left to form her all woman, her a law firm with another woman. I think it was Kathy or Madonna.
Madonna.
And this is interesting.
No, wait a minute. So she was working at DeGraff.
She was working at DeGraff, and she had left.
And against her better judgment, they hired a woman.
Well, listen, this is why. Not because they looked at my resume or anything.
No, I meant her, but.
Oh, yeah. Well, they always had to have one woman on their door thing. They always had, for many, many years, it was the wife of a partner who was a lawyer but never practiced. But her name was on the door.
So she wanted it for appearances.
Appearances.
Just didn't want her to do anything.
Exactly. So Greta, I think, got kind of fed up with that attitude and left to start her own firm.
Imagine that. She got fed up with it. Huh?
And the Albany County Bar sued them because there was a newspaper article about Greta and Madonna being the first all-woman law firm in the Capital District, and the Albany County Bar sued them for false advertising, or for advertising, because in those days, lawyers couldn't advertise.
So it wasn't the truth of it they were challenging, it was the fact that they advertised at all.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and
but
the new...
It was true, though, right?
Yes, and they saw the... They saw that newspaper article as unfair advertising against all the other lawyers.
Do you think the Albany County Bar Association did that on their own initiative, or was someone put?
I have no idea. I just wasn't. I was not involved with that.
Yet Greta Powers became the first woman president of the Albany County Bar.
Yeah.
Is she still around?
Long dead.
Now, so she formed a firm, and what was the name of the firm? Do you remember?
Powers and Gandhi.
Because, Gandhi. Madonna Stahl was then Madonna Gandhi.
Yeah, I'm not sure I knew that. I may have thought they were different people. Madonna Stahl, and Madonna Gandhi.
Yeah, one and the same.
Oh, okay. So and were they in Albany or Schenectady?
Albany.
Were they? Okay.
So let me tell you how I got the job at DeGraff. My husband had done a favor for Judge Holt Harris. And when I got no response, and no response from any firm, I asked him if he knew anybody in law firms, and he said yes, and he gave Holt Harris a call and told him that his wife had just graduated and was law review in cum laude, and was there any place, and he said send her on down. Because their woman, who was Greta, had just left.
And they needed one.
They needed one.
They needed a token woman.
They needed one, and they probably needed a token Jew, too, because they hired Rich Burstein at the same time. But we were put up in the CSEA office. CSEA was then their largest client. And we were put up in the CSEA office along with Jack Rice, whom I adored because he was the only lawyer in that firm who ever remembered my name. But so it was Jim Romer and I think Al White, Rich Burstein, and myself who formed the nucleus of the CSEA lawyers. And we were actually in the union office.
Huh, so you were, for all practical purposes, in-house counsel, but really working for DeGraff.
Exactly. DeGraff billed for our time, but we were effectively in-house counsel. And Jim Romer was up there because they didn't want him to, he was not on the partnership track, but he was very valuable as a union lawyer. So he was up there and continually, the idea was put people up there and bring them down to the 90 state. And he was always passed over. which led eventually to his taking the client away from DeGraff and forming Romer and Feathersnaw.
So Romer and Feathersnaw was established essentially to serve the needs of the CSEA.
It was the only way he could get the client. He and Jim had, I think, gone to law school together. They'd been buddies, and Jim was in practice over
Jim
in Schenectady. And Romer called him up because the union wanted a law firm. They just didn't want in-house counsel. I was their first in-house counsel. So Jim Romer called up Jim Feathersnaw and said, come over, we're going to form a law firm. And then he asked the four of us who were, or the three other lawyers who were CSE lawyers, would we come with him? And Rich and I, of course, had no place to go. Of course we were going to come with him. Al White went down to the firm.
Let me back up a second. So yeah. You're working for DeGraff and you're working at CSEA. And there comes a time when you become actual in-house counsel at CSEA?
I formed their in-house counsel.
So you've left DeGraff to become in-house, to become an employee of CSEA?
I left DeGraff to become an employee of Romer and Feathersnaw.
Okay, I'm clear now.
Yeah, then Romer and Feathersnaw were trying to oust Bill McGowan,
who was the president of CSEA. Now, why was the law firm involved in that?
Because the law firm was involved in the everyday politics and running of the union heavily. And all of us were, Jim had us all on various committees as counsel to their committee. So he knew exactly what was happening to the union at any given point. And his protege was Joe McDermott. And he wanted to force McGowan out, because Bill was more independent, and put Joe in.
And that happened, didn't Joe McDermott become president?
Of course it did, yeah. But before that happened, Bill had come to me because of the politics involved, asked me if we could engineer this, would I start an in-house law firm? And so what happened was Romer took the client away from DeGraff. I took the client away from Romer and became the first in-house general counsel and put together a law firm. I was at that time over in Troy at Patterson Sampson.
Yeah.
And we staffed it with those attorneys until I could hire my own attorneys.
So R&F...
didn't know you were going to get all this.
No, I didn't. So Romer and Feathersnaw took you because they needed someone who was intimately familiar with the CSEA.
Yes, and Rich, because we had only been CSE lawyers,
mm-hmm.
and we had worked closely and were very well liked by the union. So that we were the nucleus of their law firm.
So then the CSEA wanted to get rid of Romer and Feathersnaw, is that correct?
I think it was Bill McGowan.
I see.
Who, because he felt that they were inimical to him and wanted to put Joe in.
So I see. So there was a political fight, and the way you survived is you leave Romer and Feathersnaw and become the actual in-house counsel of the CSEA.
Yes, and put together an in-house law firm. They actually built our offices around us as we were trying. I have never adjourned so many cases in my life. And every case that Romer and Feathersnaw had, because they were the union counsel, I had to go down personally for them to hand over. It was a lesson in punishment, I think.
Did you run into any gender issues with Romer and Feathersnaw or the CSEA?
Ran into gender issues with Romer and Feathersnaw because we had, to my way of thinking, the brightest, most competent woman lawyer, Pauline Kinsella, who was a part of became a part of the law firm. Romer and Feathersnaw hired her.
Don's wife?
Yes. And she wanted to have a family. And so she asked if she could work three days a week instead of 5 days a week. And there was a lot of pushback. And I remember, because, you know, here, you've got to understand, I'm 50 years old, so these are kids to me. I have an advantage in that I am not, I'm not their age or younger. So I have that experience of coming in and saying, you know, just as an older person. And I talked to Pauline. She was going to quit. And she was just so valuable. And I said to her, you can work 3 days a week. You take off Monday and you take off Friday, so you have four good days with your kids. And then the 3 days in between, and I said, you're always available. So I pitched it to Romer, who was really the managing partner. Featherston just went along for the ride, you know.
And that aspect, but other aspects, I'm sure he's busy lobbying.
Yes. But Romer, and I said to him, here, Jim, you never talk about the male attorneys you train and then they take a job with another firm or they leave. Nobody ever tracks that, because part of my passion at that time was trying to get family leave for women and men in law firms. It was unheard of. So, and I said, here you have our best and brightest attorney, and you can meet her on the courthouse steps with a folder and say, these are the issues, go in and argue the motion, and she can do it. There's no, you know, nobody else that you have, you have to take them out of the office to do it. You can do it. And if you give her this time with her family, it doesn't last forever. I mean, child raising is a few years, and then they're off to school. I said, you will have someone who's so grateful to you, because she doesn't have to leave the firm. She doesn't have to interrupt her career. She's still valuable to you. Just like, well, the joke's in the firm about three-fifths. Do we give Pauline three-fifths of lunch? Do we give Pauline three-fifths of the ladies' room? I mean, it was that kind of atmosphere. And everybody, every guy in that firm respected her and liked her. And so she was a friend. This was supposed to be good-natured joshing. But in looking back on it, it always reminds her that she is not one of the boys. Mm-hmm. She's not serious. She doesn't work full-time. You know, that's the underlying message.
Well, crucial to that, it seems, is that she was so good. And if she was not good or mediocre...
Wouldn't have happened. Would not have happened.
I think women had to be twice as good in those days.
It's like Norma Meacham.
Yeah.
You know, the people that I knew, the women I knew in those days who were in firms were excellent. Just excellent. A lot of them head and shoulders above what you would... The bright guys who were also coming into the firm. But they had to be, or they wouldn't have gotten any place.
Now, how long have you been with CSCA?
Forever. Until I got fired. So, I was the shortest tenured counsel in history of CSCA. Because when we took the firm and made it in-house... and I got it all up and running. My guru was a guy called, Jim, what was his? He was a vice president out of the Syracuse chapter, and he ran against Joe. Now, Romer ran Joe's campaign. I'm blocking on his last name. You can see his face as clearly as possible. So my rabbi lost the race for president. And then it was just a matter of time. I mean, it's like politics. Somebody puts you in, that's a political move, and somebody, the next political, takes you out. Mm-hmm. That's the name of the game.
And it's accepted.
Yeah. No, I understand that. And I think Joe could not have been comfortable with me as the general counsel, because, well, first of all, Romer couldn't have lived with that. But I think Joe could not have been comfortable.
You perceived you as the other person?
Exactly.
Person? Sure.
I was the enemy because I had taken McGowan's side, really, against him, and ousted his rabbi, so to speak.
And then where did you go? What was next?
Then I went into private practice. Yes.
What sort of work?
Employment. That's what I was, although I went over to management instead of being, because really, at least the way I saw it in those days, if you were going to do employment law on behalf of the employee, it was really with union. There weren't too many individual. Nobody could afford to go up against OER or a big employer. And I didn't do private law. I did public law.
So I was. Let's put a time frame in this. What year are we talking roughly?
You got me. I'd have to go back and take a look at my notes.
Or even decade, 80s, 90s?
80s.
80s, okay. So it's in the 80s. And so did you go out on your own, or did you go with a firm or staff?
No, I went out on my own. And I became a management employer law. And I found that satisfying because I looked for ways to be fair to employees. On behalf of management, to get the job done, but in a way that didn't leave an employee bruised and battered and...
Happy employees are good for management.
Yeah, and it's, so when people got disciplined or people got in trouble, I was able to sort it out and kind of come to an understanding of getting rid of the employee, which was the aim, but in
a humane way,
yeah.
Now, how difficult was it to get clients for
a
woman lawyer at that point?
It was very.
How did you do it?
Just people referred to me. It was just word of mouth. We couldn't do advertising at that point. I don't know when advertising came in, but I wouldn't have done that probably anyway.
And I don't know how much you would have been in court with that, probably a fair amount, but how did the judges treat you? There were no women judges in
the
not many.
Most of the judges in Albany knew me because I'd been attached to the union for several years. But when I was doing private practice, I remember I had a criminal case with a young man, and the judge looked at me, and I was standing there, and he said, "Well, who are you, his mother?" No, I'm his lawyer.
I think I can guess who it was.
I have to tell you another thing. When I first graduated law school, and I went to most young lawyers are sent down for motion terms, nothing that you can really screw up. So I made my husband come to Macy's with me and the other stores in the mall to look for a briefcase. Because if I came down with a Redwell under my arm, I was treated as a secretary. Nobody looked at me as a lawyer. I remember marching up and down the aisle in Macy's, trying out briefcases. Does this look good? Is this too big? My poor husband was like, "You're nuts." But it was important, and it was an important prop.
Now let's shift to the woman's bar. How did that all get started? What was your role in that?
This happened because several of my friends, we got together. We were new lawyers, and new lawyers don't know anything. None of us had any real experience. So when you got your first job, the alternative was to ask the boys, and then you felt you were putting yourself in a position of Miss Know-Nothing, And we didn't want to give them the opportunity. So a group of us got together and decided to have lunch, I think it was once a month. We called ourselves the Albany Women Lawyers Association. And each of us took 20 minutes or half hour at lunch to teach what we had just learned. Because the new lawyer in every firm gets whatever the partners or the senior lawyers don't want. So I got stuck with ERISA, it had just come out. I got stuck with the Comprehensive Employment Training Act, which had just come out, and nobody wanted to wade through the regulations. So each of us had been assigned something that we were learning. So we taught each other at these luncheons. We would give a 20 to 30 minute talk on something that we were doing and share that information. And that became the network that we all went to. When I needed something else, I would call Rachel, or I'd call Ann Copps, or we had our own source of networking for information without having to appear to the males in the firm that we didn't know anything.
And time frame again, generally when are we talking about when these girls started?
Well, we started the women's bar in 1980.
So
this must have been...
was the local.
74 I graduated, so it must have been 75, 76 at the latest.
And at this point, this was just kind of an informal group.
Yes, a luncheon group. We met once a month, and one of us agreed to do something. And
how many did we have?
I don't know, maybe 30, if that. There weren't that many. Our class was 15. I don't know what the next class through Albany was, but that was our local... fount of membership was the law school.
At that time, in the mid-70s, when you got out of law school, were there any female women role models to be had in this region?
Well, there was Madonna and Greta. What can I say? Those are the only two names that come to mind.
So then back to
now, Beth Tobin wasn't yet a judge.
No,
but
she was practicing with her husband.
Right, right, right. Which, by the way, when we interviewed her, she also mentioned that at the time she also had some help from her husband, you know.
Well, if it hadn't been for his, I wouldn't have had a job.
Right, because as women alone... You know, and this was shortly before I got out, so I didn't experience the same level of discrimination in 1978 when I graduated.
Sure.
I mean, things had changed a lot just during that period.
Well, here's the other thing. When I graduated in 74, this kid who was a very mediocre student went down to the bank and got a couple of credit cards. I went down to the bank and they had, and I had to have my husband sign the application to get a credit card. I'm a lawyer.
Yeah.
I have a salary and one of the highest of all of the associates in my class, all of the lawyers in my class. And the only basis was that I was female, so.
Now illegal, I'm sure.
I hope so.
So at this point, you've got kind of a informal group, informal luncheon group, not a formal bar. How does it evolve into a formal bar?
This is what happened. It was Joan Ellenbogen from the New York chapter, one of the big matrimonial bombers. I mean, she was really right up there, decided that we should have a statewide women's bar. So they came courting us. When they found a group, they came to court us. And I, frankly, was bowled over. These women were so competent. They were partners in big-time urban law firms. They got paid enormous salaries from our point of view. And they knew what they were doing, and they were really political stars in terms of knowing how to work a group politically or control a group politically. So they came up to us, and frankly, I just was in love with them. I thought they were magnetic. They were everything that we wanted to be in terms of prestige and power and influence and place. And they were the role models, I think. They were my first role models.
So at the time that the statewide women's bar, at least a women's bar in New York, in New York City, was well established.
Yes. It wasn't.
The New York City bar was well established at that time, 50 years.
Westchester, New York, Bronx, Brooklyn, they all had women's bar associations stemming from the time when they weren't allowed to join the male bar association. So those were all 30 years or more old, very highly established women's bar associations because they had been excluded. That's not how we came. And when Joan decided that she wanted to be have a statewide organization, Capital was normal. Joan Ellenbogen, since deceased, but she was the heart and soul of the idea of a statewide women's bar association. And so they came to us because we were by then a fairly large group of women outside New York. So if she wanted statewide, she had to have someone who wasn't from Westchester on down. And so she was the first president. I was the second. And we started with five chapters. And then I was president 2 years, and by that time,
what
we had 15, 82 to 84. So when I left, we had 15
right,
chapters.
She tripled the size of the state in 2 years, which is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, we had a dog and pony show, and I would take people like Myrna Felder and Irene Sullivan, Sheila Birnbaum, and Rachel and Ann Mead on a dog and pony show, and we would travel. Every time we saw more than five women having lunch together, and they were lawyers, we would invite ourselves to a meeting, and we would go there, and we would tout the hopes and aspirations of having a statewide organization. And that's how we gathered our chapters from Buffalo to the tip of Long Island to Suffolk.
Now, so the movement seems to be gaining some momentum. We're talking the early 80s, or by the mid-80s, then Chief Judge Cook establishes a task force that studies the courts for 2 years.
Let me tell you about that, because we heard that New Jersey had a task force on women in the courts, and we thought, anything New Jersey can do, we can do better. So we went, I was president at the time, we went to Larry Cook and said, will you constitute a task force? Knowing, we didn't know how Wachter would be. We knew that Cook was very friendly to us. He was enormously supportive to us. And we knew if he could establish it, even though he was the outgoing chief judge, the next one couldn't dissolve it. So we would have it. It would
was
be
it
up and going.
Was it known that Wachter would be the next chief? Or you
I don't know. I think we knew that. I honestly can't remember,
okay.
But we knew that Cook was at the
was
end
leaving.
Of was, he was leaving.
So Cook was receptive, and he wanted to
yes
get an inroad while you had
right.
a sympathetic ear.
Right, and so he established it, and Wachter supported it, and we did with the state bar. I remember Hal Fales was the president of the state bar at that time. And I remember when I walked into the first meeting, and this is, I mean, somebody naive woman from upstate New York, never been in politics, you know, been a housewife for 20 years. We walked into that first meeting with Judge Cook, and it was a U-shaped table, and I was walking down the table. Joan almost tackled me and hissed in my ear, "You sit next to Judge Cook." So I just went and sat next to Judge Cook, and the eyes, like, popped out all along the table. But we did fact-finding. We did intensive listening around the state, and we did publish a report. But I have to tell you that the report clearly showed that before the bench, on the bench, in the law, outside of the law, that women, there was intense discrimination against women, cultural. This was not necessarily a personal one-on-one, but the whole culture was set that way.
Are you talking about legal culture or the broader
legal.
Culture?
Legal. Well, the broader culture, obviously, and the legal culture followed suit.
By the time this report comes out, Sal Wachter's chief judge, I think.
Yes, he is. But let me tell you that there was a woman assigned to us from OCA by the name of Adrienne White. She was a black woman, and she was kind of our keeper, our administrator. And when we had all of this information before us, and we still, women, I think, still, we don't like to be uncomfortable. We don't like to be, we didn't at that time, let me say, like to be assertive or in your face. It was Adrienne who said to us, "You have the facts before you. You have to tell them." I mean, we needed her to come out with the strength of the report that we did, because we were really, in essence, accusing the whole legal system and all the judges of being biased. And that was easy thing.
So what you're saying is essentially, if you've got a nice report, don't let it just sit on the shelf.
Exactly.
What was Judge Walker's response? Was he when he saw the report? Or
I think he was supportive. I always admired him. I think in the end he just he did what men in power do when women who are under their power don't do what they want.
And he can't stop beating up on himself. I'm in regular contact
with
him. And I keep telling him, it's going to be 88 in a few weeks.
See?
Tell him, you've had 87 exemplary years and one really bad one. I'm not sure my ratio is all that as good as
I had great. I had great respect for
And I still do. Anyhow, so what was the result of all this? What changes? I know it was very, very gradual and very incremental, but as a result of this study, this report, the formation of a women's bar, the gradually increasing number of women in law schools, what were the changes you saw in, say, the later 80s, the 90s?
I can't speak to that, John, for this reason, that my legal career was spent in arbitration and negotiation. So I did not connect with the legal system. I did not. Women's lives intersect most with family court. We weren't the corporations. We came in because of families or criminals or because our children were in trouble. And I was never in those types of practice, legal practice. So I know that there were strides made, but I'm probably not the person who can give you the information about the legal structure. I do know when Karen Peters and Vicki Graffio, and there was a third one who were running for Supreme Court.
Mary Donahue.
Mary Donahue. I remember the Albany papers referring to them as the Supremes.
Yes.
I was probably writing, but I don't remember doing that.
And that was, the Supremes, of course, were a very highly respected black women's singing group. So
let's jump to the present. At the time, right now, we've got, I don't know what the percentage is at the law school now, but in recent years, half or more have been women. Women hold a majority in the Court of Appeals again, and did for a number of years, some years back.
And the appellate division in the third department. When we needed a woman on the third department appellate division, we had to go to Buffalo and get Ann Michaels. There was not a single woman in our pipeline here.
And similarly, the first minority on the appellate division has been there all of about a year and a half, and she's from somewhere in New York City, Brooklyn maybe?
Yeah.
Just been opening the pipeline. Two of the last three chief judges have been women. The last two presiding justices of the appellate division are a woman. Is the battle over? Have you arrived? Women arrived?
No, I don't think we've arrived. I think that the culture is changing. I think, this is my new soapbox, John. I think we are on a wave now of changing from our personal stories of discrimination to looking at the cultural discrimination and going at it in a, I can't use the term global, but going at it in the larger sense of culture. I think that there is a wave now simply because the media has picked up and some very strong and able women have made sexual harassment alive and real, and they've been believed and the media has picked them up. But now is the time for us to say, okay, now we have to look at the culture. Why are half of the law students women, but 19% of partners in any law firm statewide are women? Why is that disparity? That's what we've got to work on now. And there are signs. Europe is doing it. Norway's minister of something or other, you can do this in Norway, made an order that 40% of corporate boards, these are private corporate boards, should be women. Germany has done the same thing. And the evidence is beginning to show that where you have diversity of all kinds, you have a healthier, more financially appropriate, a healthier, stronger entity. And that's what we've got to work on now. Women we've tried to be like men. We've tried to be aggressive and assertive and sharp and all those things. And now what we have to do is stand up and say, what we bring to the table is equally important. We are cooperative. That's the way mostly in which we approach things, is we try to get things together, try to look for a solution. We don't battle it out. Our model is not physical force, where everybody comes out bloodied. That, to me, is the wave that we have to, that's here and now. And the media is onto it, and we have to seize that and start looking at culture diversity and start attacking that culture. This has always been the standard put-off. There's no one to choose from. There's nobody in the pipeline. You have to pay your dues. You know, it's always been that system where you had to give to the party in order to be recognized and given back, because the judgeships, let's face it, have been handed out like plums, too many of them. And we were always told that the reason that we weren't on the bench was because we hadn't paid our dues, we didn't have people pipelines. I remember working with human rights people who had the same excuse. We can't find blacks, we can't find Hispanics, they're just not out there. Well, they are out there, and women are out there too. You just have to ask a few questions and look around. But when it came to a political appointment, they were able to skip over all those qualifications. Didn't matter if you'd paid your dues or had judicial experience. I'm talking, actually, and I should really come out and say this because I need to set the record straight on this. When the women's bar found Judith Kaye, who in my opinion, and the opinion of most of us, is a great, great chief judge. I have nothing but respect for that woman. But when she came up, it was her name and Betty Ellerin's name, and we had been told for decades, you have to have someone in the pipeline, you have to pay your dues. Betty Ellerin had been in the pipeline. Betty Ellerin was a respected judge on the Appellate Division, First Department. Betty Ellerin had paid her dues 10 times over. And so we felt very optimistic that we had fulfilled all the qualifications. And then out of nowhere, Cuomo picks Judith Kaye. Never been a judge, her husband paid dues in the way of substantial political contributions, never had practiced or been anywhere near family law, criminal law, which is where women's lives intersect with the court.
Yeah, she's been a commercial lawyer her whole career.
I thought she was, in my opinion, perhaps our greatest chief judge. I just admire everything she did. But when she was presented to us, here we had a candidate that at long last met the qualifications, and we had one who didn't meet the qualifications at all. And had Judith Kaye been a man and we had said, sorry, she's not qualified, there wouldn't have been the brouhaha. But we had a very valid reason. It was not a political... I was president at the time, and I know what our reasoning was. And sure, there were some who wanted Betty on the court and would have done, you know, would have played the politics. We really didn't. We had a very legitimate beef that we'd been lied to for decades. And that doesn't take away from the hindsight that says this was a great chief judge. And she did more for women in her tenure than any other chief judge that I'm aware of, which is not to
yes,
say much.
Yes, she is my single greatest role model
Yes,
ever.
Absolutely.
And she never seemed to hold a grudge.
She never did. I went to see her. I asked for an interview with her after she had been appointed. And we sat and talked for an hour, a little more than an hour. She was very gracious. But I went to tell her that it looked like a very crass political ploy, and it wasn't. We really had very legitimate reasons. And if you had switched those two, you know, switched the gender, I think it would have not been seen the way it was, that we turned on a woman because we wanted our own woman. It wasn't that.
I'm glad to have it on the record.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the, that is an important part of the historic record.
I do too. It doesn't change that in hindsight, everybody, I mean, Judith was great.
Yeah.
She really was. And she did more for women than, in my opinion, than any other chief judge. On her own. It wasn't that we had to go to her and say, let's do this or let's do that. Judith did it on her own.
Yeah, she's one of the truly historic people I've ever really known well.
Yeah. And fortunately, because of her graciousness, we all came to know her well. And she was a good friend to the women's bar.
Thanks for listening to Amici. You find all of our recent podcasts on the court system's website at www.nycourts.gov. And most are also in the iTunes podcast library. If you have a suggestion for an Amici podcast, please let me know. I'm John Carr, and I can be reached at 518-453-8669 or jcaher@nycourts.gov. In the meantime, stay tuned.